This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to another episode of Hurdy Code at NDC Oslo, and now we're talking to Ian Cooper, who we've never had on the show. We're always trying to get him on the show, so welcome, Ian.
Yeah, we've managed to time it this time around, haven't we? So.
It's good. So you did a talk yesterday about microservices.
I did, yeah.
And I was just interested to get your take on how you define that term and if you think it's useful.
Yeah, I think it's a really good one question. So I think there's a red herring, which is that the term micro is implying a given number of lines of code. And I know that, you know, early on people like Fred George, that was their kind of definition of microservices, but I think the term has escaped those early users of the word and got more into the wild. I'm pretty comfortable with the definition Fowler and Lewis give, which is to say, you know, that actually really that we're looking for a bounded context around a business capability within your domain. Mm-hmm. So it depends then really on your... The actual size is going to be dependent on your domain and what makes sense to break up in your domain. Mm-hmm. I think the thing we're noticing is that you might have broken up bigger business capabilities before by going around to business, to seeing what it does, saying, okay, here's the actuarial department, which rates insurance policies for us. And you might want to nowadays say, well, is that far enough down the line, or can I go a little bit further? Because this is trade-off, which is the smaller I get, the more risk-tolerant I can become. If I move in a world where I have continuous deployment, so I can just push the button and release quite rapidly, and I've got decent contracts around my service so I can actually test it quite easily, then I may become more comfortable about the risk of deploying, and rather than having an extended release hardening period, I might say, well, actually, if I've only got a few hundred lines of changes in this code from one story, then my surface error of what's changed is small. So my ability to release and fix a problem when it occurs is greater. Okay. And so that's why there's not quite a lot of emphasis on microservices as well on this model of saying, well, if you can't QA everything, you need to basically be able to monitor and respond to issues rapidly. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of shift from us saying, let's do this really heavy upfront QA quality assurance process that essentially takes us ages and basically denies getting out stored value, to a model where we say, that's just enough QA, and then actually try and react by redeploying and monitoring in live.
So what I'm hearing you say is this is really more related to DevOps than necessarily size of teams or physical deployments.
So I think there's a DevOps element to it. So in terms of what triggers this kind of microservices architecture, right? So the point I make is that if you have that human beings can take, usually can manage to understand about 35 to 50,000 lines of code. When your project gets bigger, then you need to break it up. Human beings can work in teams up to about 12 people. It's like has two pizza rule. Beyond that, it begins to break apart. So at those points, because you have to break up your system into more deployables in order to basically to either say, I can reason about the software more effectively because the number of lines of code is great. I mean, 50,000 if you're young. At my age, I've destroyed a few 20 brain cells over the years. 35,000 is probably a little bit better. Or essentially because you say, well, you know, there's the ideal team is supposedly four guys in a room with a whiteboard. So a few more teams would actually be better than trying to cross-communicate in one. And that's when you get this urge to break things up. And the kind of argument I say is that, you know, we've had essentially the model we're all trying to pursue in various incarnations is a component-based architecture. We're saying break this system up into a series of components, and those components should be autonomous. We've had various attempts at it. You know, one was the DCOM, CORBA, COMPLUS, you know, generation. The next generation around was really SOA. And microservices are really the next kind of attempt to say, hey, here's the current set of best practices and the kind of architectural style we believe works best to deliver this kind of application. I can pretty much guarantee, you know, we will learn more, and in a few years' time, there will be another tag given to whatever we think the best way of doing component-based architectures is, but that pattern remains the same. I think it's useful to understand that because you can look back at SOA and, you know, even DCOM, CORBA, and say there are things we can learn from that and take forward. You need to be careful when you review that literature to make sure you understand which bits are now said we failed on, which bits we say we succeeded at. So one of my classic examples is RPC. I see a lot of people doing RPC with microservices. We know RPC has a lot of problems, particularly problems around coupling to the kind of behavior. So the way I always describe this is, if I say to you, make me a cup of tea, I leave it up to you to decide how tea is best made, right? You can use a pot, put it in the cup, milk in first, after. Mm-hmm. You are the tea expert, make me a fine cup of tea. If I say to you, fill the kettle, boil some water, I as the client am making all the decisions for you about how that tea is made. Or if you've actually defined that API, if you want to change it, you suddenly realize that putting the milk in first, it's a disaster in a cup, then you've got to say to all your clients, well, hang on a minute, you guys are going to have to change. You have to rewrite your code, take advantage of our new API, actually an API version 2. So we know RPC's got lots of problems. So one of the learnings we should take forward from the kind of SOA, DCOM mirror into microservices is to say prefer messaging.
So, you know, there's more simplicity when you break things into smaller pieces. I can reason about a smaller piece, but then you do bring in the complexity of all these pieces working together, multiple points of failure, communication.
Right, yeah.
So how do you manage that?
So that's where this whole problem called nanoservices comes in, which essentially says you can get fragmented logic, poor performance, and increased management overhead. So if you break it, if you go too small, then actually the overhead of every service becomes greater than the utility value of having broken up into separate pieces. And I say there's a kind of Goldilocks zone, and unfortunately, I think it's a bit finger in the wind to try and guess where that is, because it depends on your domain, which says it's not too big, it's not too small, it's just right. And I think this is why some people are saying right now, you know, it's really hard to do microservices out of the gate, because it's really hard to get a feel in a new domain of where those points at which you can kind of like slice this thing up are that are effectively. So that's why maybe it is best to start building something that looks a bit monolithic, as your team's probably got smaller numbers of people, smaller numbers of line of code to deal with. And then as you begin to get a feel for the domain and how it works, you'll get a feel for these seams where you can essentially break it up and get this trade-off right between the utility of something smaller versus the cost of something smaller.
What's a good way to manage these services? Like, once you've got them all running, there is, like you mentioned, a bit of a DevOps aspect to it. Like, how do you best manage and profile and, you know, make sure that it's all functioning smoothly?
Yeah, there's some pretty good tool suites emerging. I mean, we use, for example, New Relic. There's a whole range of tools which essentially will introspect your app and provide you with information on how it's running and the various layers that basically you have in your application. There's things like logging, obviously, and there are tools. The problem with logging becomes that I now have significant number of logs spread across a vast number of machines. How do I deal with that? So tools like Logstash and Splunk start to deal with that problem of saying, I want to collect all my data together. And you need to start thinking about things like, well, if I'm going to have all these logs, how do I correlate information? So you start to be thinking about messages having goods that basically flow across between those logs so that you can kind of track an individual flow of a piece of a problem across a whole range of your services as it flows through stuff. Then there are obviously issues around things like being able to run stuff in production and make sure it's alive. So you then need to get things like console. And there's also things to do with essentially, say, service discovery. Well, rather than hard coding stuff into my actual config file, could I actually register services and find out where they are when they're running? So that's, again, that console zookeeper people use for that. There's a range of tooling out there around these kind of issues now.
So we're not really, we're not completely throwing away some of the SOA principles, right? This is still about having autonomous services, not sharing types.
Exactly. I think you've still got autonomous components that have well-defined stable interfaces that are decoupled and that work the same. We've learned a lot about how you can fail at building those. We've learned a lot about how you succeed at building those, and we should bake a lot of that in to the next generation. Microservices, to some extent, is trying to carry that forward. Ideas like bounded context, business capability, are trying to take those ideas forward.
And there will be some sort of standard messaging or queuing protocol between these, and they can be implemented however you want.
Yeah, so your choices end up really being some kind of protocol like HTTP or sockets between the services, right? And that can be an effective way of doing it. You get some issues there with, if I'm calling you and I'm calling you via, say, HTTP API, you kind of need to be up, right? So I can get away with some things in HTTP, but potentially you can be cached behind some kind of proxy. I can cache you locally on the client. I can cope with your downtime a bit. Other way of doing that is then to say, well, I'm actually going to prefer messaging via a lightweight broker instead. So those are really the two major options. There's this idea called smart endpoints, dumb pipes, saying don't use something like a service bus or a big process manager in the middle where essentially the logic bleeds out of your services into this centralized hub, but stick with actually keeping the smarts in the applications and use these lightweight mechanisms. The thing I always say is, you know, if you're using something like an HTTP API like that, it seems very simple to keep going, but then you do have to start thinking about service discovery, some kind of cluster management via some kind of tooling like console, because you need to say, well, I need to have something I can keep up. I need to have something I can discover. Using a broker, like a broker like RabbitMQ, takes away some of that complexity for you.
Right.
So to plug my ISS project, one of the things we do is we have a project called Brighter, which we use. And it has two parts to it. One part is we have a kind of command dispatcher stroke processor where we say, hey, here's a command. We map it to a handler. And we let you run, we run a pipeline, Russian doll style pipeline, where you can insert orthogonal operations like logging, monitoring. But the other part of it is we have a task queue, essentially, implementation, which says some of those commands, rather than actually handle them synchronously, I want to just put them out onto a message queue via a lightweight broker and have another process running somewhere else handle that piece of work. And you can use that technology stack to do microservices very lightweight. And we really try to make it very simple to the developer who simply has to write a command and a handler. We take away most of the plumbing from you. So you have a company called Service Activator, which you just run inside your service. You probably want to use like Top Shelf to create your Windows service. And essentially we say, right, you just declare the channels that you're using on the broker. We will map commands to handlers for you, read them off the queue. Use kind of a message pump to basically reach stuff out, translate it, spit it out to various handlers.
Okay.
We handle that for you, and we handle also this idea of a pipeline. So we handle, we use a library called Poly to handle retry, circuit breaker, and timeouts. One of the things you need to think about when you go to distributed system is that you're now subject to the fallacy of distributed computing. If I call from my process to your process, one of the problems early on with these kind of like strategies, but basically decom, was the idea was that the local call inter-process call like a local call. The problem is it can fail because the network may be just temporarily down, the other service may be down, so you need to have strategies like timeout to say, well, I'm not going to wait forever, retry, so maybe the best thing to do is just try again because maybe you'll be back up and I'll succeed, or circuit breaker saying, hey, you're down, and let's not flood the damaged component with more repeated retry requests because that's just going to make the situation worse.
Sure.
We'll handle that for you. We use a library called Poly. You can plug that into your pipeline so that you just declaratively say, I want to retry this handler, I want to time out this handler, and I want to circuit break it. And we're kind of inspired by Hystrix, if you know that.
So the project name is Brighter. And it's on GitHub under
Ian Cooper.
Under Ian Cooper. Okay.
So is that a .NET assembly? It's
.NET. Yep, okay. It was all written in C#.
I was going to say, so if I have service A and service B, I can just reference this assembly from both of those services internally, right?
Yep.
And it can, and then, okay, so I can use it to talk like via RabbitMQ.
Yep, exactly.
Two,
right? We currently support RabbitMQ. We're working on some implementations for Azure and SQS.
Okay.
And we've kind of suggested we might produce one for Redis as well. There's a kind of broker in the middle. We're kind of constrained to a broker architecture. I do have an experimental somewhere implementation of a much forgotten broker protocol called RestMS, which is a REST-based broker, which was written by Peter Hitchens. I think I may be one of the few people in the world that actually remembers it exists. But that's in a separate place. You can go and look at that if you're interested in how that might work.
Okay. Yeah, and this is a project that you actively use with...
So we actively use it at Huddle. So I kind of... We had something similar to Huddle. We kind of wrote a first version of Huddle, and I was kind of, well, it's my fault, right? I wrote it, but I was kind of dissatisfied with some of the implementation details we had. We tried to use RX quite heavily on the server. We met a number of issues with using RX, for example, heavily on the server around ability to start and stop subscriptions. And I know I've seen Bart Smet talk about having hit similar problems and some potential new version of RX which solves that. We rewrote it and just used a classic old school Windows message pump style, you know, loop and things like that. And then the open source version was the clean version. And then we took that back into our project in this kind of perverse way of doing it to say, okay, now that we're now going to use this clean version and replace our version with that clean version. So we run that in production. And we have, we appeared on the ThoughtWorks Technology Radar. So we got some love there.
Yeah.
And we're slowly getting, and mainly, people are kind of alumni of Huddle, people that have moved on to new jobs, taking it out into their new jobs. We'd love to get more adoption, and we have a set of issues, and feel free to come and contribute. We'd love to get more participation.
Yeah, yes. And where would people get started? There's some wiki pages on your...
We actually have documentation. Yeah. It took me a long slog to write, but if you go to the GitHub pages...
Wait, which is it? Is it an open source project, or do you have documentation?
I know. I slogged away because I decided the only way to get someone to use your project was actually to write some decent documentation for it. One of the things I'd really love, actually, is feedback on the documentation, because it makes a lot of sense to me. But then I know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
But we also explain some stuff like hexagonal architectures. We use it quite a lot to support hexagonal architecture styles, where we use our command dispatcher. So you can read a lot about the theory as well as the implementation of why you might want to use it.
Could it be in process too?
Yeah, so we basically give you the option. And the idea is, though it's not quite straightforward, is that you can say command processor send, publish, or post. Send says one client, publish says many clients, both in process, and post says actually send it out asynchronously to another handler.
Gotcha.
The theory being you could switch from send a publish to post by just changing that, and we would then you just move your handler out to another service.
Yep.
Of course, the reality is that you may find that changes the interaction that you've got on the UI or your API as a result of made it async, but the business of actually changing your handler to run asynchronously rather than synchronously is not the problem area anymore.
Sure. So when you're not building a command processor and you're not at Huddle and you're not at NDC, what do you do to have fun or relax?
My partner gave birth to our daughter 14 months ago, so that now consumes much of the rest of my time nowadays. She's great. She has no capacity for understanding danger of any sort, and I've realized that I only have one job as a parent, and that is to keep them alive.
Yeah.
Everything else is kind of a bonus on top of that if they turn out nicely or anything, but I think my job involves survival.
Very good. Well, that's a full-time job.
Yes.
In itself. Thanks for finally getting onto the show, Ian.
Hey, it's good to talk to you guys,
and thanks for listening.